Hi, welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Kadenak, and joining me is West Coast and Carlton legend and author of Inside, Chris Chubb.
Thanks for having me on.
One of the themes running throughout the book is how love sort of turned into obsession in that way that you needed to love playing and love the process, but also be obsessed with playing and obsessed with the process to be able to be the elite athlete. Are you comfortable now with it, being able to switch that off after that time?
Yeah, but it's an interesting process. And I feel I'd already started to switch it off in the last couple of years of my footy career because I simply couldn't train, well, even more than the last couple of years of my footy career, I simply couldn't train as hard as I would have liked.
Yeah.
And both personally and at a club level, we weren't getting the results that we would have liked, and I was battling ageing, which is a battle you can't win. So I even sort of recognised toward the end of my career, to keep paying a higher and higher price, there wasn't really much point in doing that. So sort of becoming human again, without being melodramatic, has been going on for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
But that's a process that'll keep going for the next few years, I'm sure.
Is it difficult, in those later years, is it difficult the transition? I felt like you were comfortable with the transition from going from captain to leader when Mark Murphy took over, but you also talk about the difficulty of the pressure when Mick Malthouse came in and he didn't know how to read you because you couldn't bridge the gap between being disinterested or appearing disinterested and also appearing to step back from that. That must have been a lot of pressure that you mightn't have wanted in your later sort of couple of years.
No, it was fine, honestly. Well, from my perspective, I think it just probably took us a little while to work each other out, but we had a great relationship and I sort of felt really close to him. But I was at an age where I wasn't really seeking approval as much as probably guys who were in that early phase of their career. So I was happy to roll along and certainly give Mark the space that I felt he probably needed as a young captain. But as time went on, I probably felt more comfortable trying to give some assistance as well so that I could help him through that early phase of his leadership.
Another theme in the book that we talk about, and we talked about it earlier, is that, and I'll hark back to a story that I've told you, that if you do a bit of a deep dive on Chris Judd on YouTube and you dig up a few interviews, one of them is you go on the Footy Show not long after you've done your knee, and you hobble on. There's the standard sort of tomfoolery that happens on the Footy Show, and the first question you get in front of this packed house, you get a standing ovation, is why don't you do media? Is that frustrating to you that through your career that people have this concept that you don't do media? I mean, you're doing media now. You're not even,
Yeah, I've probably done more media than any Carlton player in my time at the footy club. But I guess it was never something I really sought out. So I think that's where it's born. And a lot of guys do a lot of media while they're playing because they're hoping to have a career in the media post-footy. And that just wasn't a huge interest to me, and I was also really aware that I had limited time like everyone, and doing media wasn't going to help the clubs I was playing for achieve success, so it was pretty easy to draw a line through that and put my energies towards either trying to help achieve that or spend time with people that I wanted to spend time with.
Do you think it's easier being an introvert or an extrovert in a footy club?
I'm probably an extrovert. I mean, I just think extroverts in modern day society, it's probably easier to be. They're sort of revered, and if you look at social media and what's put up on a pedestal, it's an era of extroverts. Whereas 100 years ago, if you were extroverted, you would have seemed to have had no manners and been rude and been arrogant. So that's the era we live in. But I think it's important for introverts to be aware that there's nothing wrong if you don't feel comfortable spending your life taking selfies or having the bright lights on you. I think it's perfectly natural for both extroverts and introverts to coexist.
Because we're talking about, when we talk about extroverts in the NFL, you talk about one of the biggest is Jason Ackermanis, but he was told by the Western Bulldogs not to do his handstands after things, and then I think he disobeyed once, and whereas now, and that was only, the Bulldogs, I reckon that's probably, six, seven years ago when he was there, and when he was warned probably against it, now, a bit longer than that, but now you'd think if someone came in and did a handstand after a game and in that short space of time, they'd be a social media sensation. I mean,
probably. I think that probably speaks more towards individuality and sort of groupthink as well. If you've got opinions which are in conflict with the footy clubs or the group, he's not really a place for you in AFL. That's one of the things that I've felt mildly relieved about since retiring, is you can just have an opinion and not in the back of your mind have to weigh it up as to if it correlates with what the club's position or the AFL's position on an issue could be. So it's been refreshing not to have to deal with the groupthink anymore.
Yeah. A part of the book that really struck me, and I think I reread it, is when you talk about, and we talked about earlier, about the obsession with Aussie rules and what you have to do and how you have to make that your priority and be, I don't think you use these words, but you have to kind of be selfish to yourself. So in your life, fatty foods issue, no worries, I'll cut it out, different things like that. And then Beck got pregnant. And in the book, you describe how you worry about that you might resent Oscar because he is, you know, might be taking part of your focus away. I mean, I think it's a brave admission, but I can also see that everyone must be feeling that way. Now I look and see your story and the obsession. I mean, was that difficult for you to confront in the book? Did you think about leaving that part out? I mean, it paints you very well because you're
It was good it didn't happen.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah, it was just something I was conscious of. I just know that anything that got in the way of my football up until that point just got eradicated from my life. Now, Oscar's life's never a threat.
No.
Let's make that very clear.
Sorry, I don't need to.
I was just conscious that this was something I needed to be careful of. You know, there's a fair bit of chatter in my mind and probably in everyone's, really. You're always just acutely aware of what's going on in your own mind. But yeah, I was really conscious that this arrival of this little person was such a blessing and was obviously so much more important than football. And in the end, that's how I felt when he came. But I just wanted to make sure that was how it was going to be, regardless of if that's how I was feeling. But I was lucky that that's how I was feeling naturally anyway.
Yeah, and it seems like whenever I have friends that play sport, they say that public pressure is a great thing. Like, it can be annoying. But the pressure of, in that case, if you didn't have sleep on a Friday night, you're playing a Saturday game, it's not great, but it helps your performance. If you do have thousands of people saying, what was wrong with you, Juddy? Why didn't you play well? Or in a workplace, if you had that, you'd have a breakdown. You know. But when they play with that public pressure, I mean, it's a hindrance, but it helps. It seems like, reading your book, that there was this internal pressure. And it's quite matter of fact, a lot of the stuff that you go through that I'm reading, and I think the sacrifices you're making are great. But you sort of say, well, like you said, you just take it out. Fatty foods, take it out, do different things. You start playing chess because you want different challenges. I mean, have you always been like that? Do you see from other AFL players that you need a kind of single-minded discipline to be able to succeed?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty strong correlation with probably most high achievers in it, you know, transcends fields. I mean, we had a well-known basketballer come and speak to us at West Coast that played with some of the best NBA players of all time. And the question got put to him, what did all these guys, the best players you played with, have in common? And he said, to be honest, the rest of their lives was completely stuffed.
Yeah.
You know, their marriages were terrible. Relationship with family and friends were terrible. They just put so much energy into their basketball that there was nothing else in their life survived. And I think most people that achieve really highly in one area of their life, there's usually a cost in other areas. And my case wasn't as dramatic as that, but certainly in terms of the foods I ate or being able to catch up with friends outside of football industry, travelling like other young people would have the opportunity. There's a whole host of things that probably suffered because I put all my energies into football, and that was a trade I was more than happy to make, but it was certainly a cost which I was aware of and probably became more aware of towards the back end of my career when I guess the reward for that sacrifice wasn't occurring.
And but your relationship with football, even when you were younger, I mean, as older as you talk about, and I'll call it a bit of rubbish now meeting you, is that, you know, the whole media shy and sort of being a little bit aloof and, you know, not being obsessed with football. When you were younger, you talk about hanging out with kids at the skate park and stuff like that, and footy was important and the process was important, but you didn't watch every game of footy every week and things like that. I mean, do you think that, I mean, now in your personal life, do you find yourself just as driven for different projects? Do you think that footy was just something that you found rather than, does that make sense? So
if it does, I think that drive now will be translated to other endeavours. Yeah, I think there'll be some crossover. So I've always enjoyed, you know, sort of achieving things and achieving goals. And, you know, that won't be footy anymore, but I think that'll be pushed over into other endeavours.
Yeah. So reading the book, and we'll go deep into inside Chris Chardon here, but in Forrest Gump, this is my analogy with Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump is basically, it gets ridiculous and great at the same time, because he crosses into all these key moments in American history. You know, he sort of wanders accidentally into Watergate, things like that. The career of Chris Judd, you've been in parts of really controversial moments in AFL for the last 10 years. You've got the West Coast saga, which you write, and I stress again, you write really intelligently about all those processes. One thing that I thought you hadn't been anywhere near was the Essendon drug saga. But there is a mention, and it's again a really good example for readers of how close and how you assume that professional sport is rule of an iron fist and everyone lays a gram and things like that. But tell us about just the story, we'll spoil it a little bit, about your connection with what would eventually lead to Carlton talking to a certain doctor and then knocking them back, obviously. But how close you could have, if someone had have said to you, knock it on the head, Chris, you're not going to do that, how close you could have been connected to that whole saga, I guess.
Yeah, well, I guess there was, you know, a well-known pharmacist in Melbourne trying to sell products from his compound pharmacy to, I assume, various AFL clubs. And he was, you know, he was talking like he was selling to other clubs, including Essendon. Whether he was or he wasn't remains to be proven. So you can't deduce too much from that. But, yeah, look, it was one of those weird situations where I got wind of this before it was sort of public knowledge, and so then when it blew up, it was probably didn't come as quite a big a surprise to me as other people, but it has been such a high profile saga in our game, and one that, you know, looks like it's probably going to drag on for a little while longer yet. But I, as I say in the book, was, you know, you just feel lucky at a footy club that you didn't have to be put in that situation, because you know, it's not one any player ever expects to be put in, and players implicitly do have a whole heap of trust in the medical staff of their clubs,
which you did, because didn't your friends say it's great and you can, it does this and everything? Yeah, and you took that to the doctor and said, that's doping, Chris.
Yeah. So yeah, it would have been interesting to see what had happened if he had have said that's fine. I mean, a simple search online would have showed that it was banned.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just don't know. But to have people that are smart and on top of those sort of things is really important.
Yeah. Something that has always annoyed me, and even before I read this book, is that you often get the question, and I apologise for even putting it out there, but when they talk about the West Coast party days, they say, was your career tainted, or was the premiership tainted, which annoys me, but I'm not going to put words in your mouth. But in the book, I think you talk about the sacrifice, and you talk about what that West Coast culture was. And it's really easy to draw a line between what happened off the field and off the training paddocks and how hard everybody worked. And I don't want to be a sycophant or anything, but I think I'd never heard it really put in those terms. And I guess if you want to talk a little bit about both the captaincy, the Ben Cousins thing, you talk really quite beautifully about drug addiction and how people think Ben Cousins is smiling on the field and they go, geez, he's just happy, he's rubbing everyone's faces. But that's a football, that's what footballers do.
Yeah, well, I think when people talk about the premiership being tainted, it's very important they differentiate between illicit drugs and performance-enhancing drugs. And the two are completely separate. Some people use them interchangeably, which is, you know, really misleading for the public.
I've seen on the couch, and a certain AFL journalist has said to Ben Cousins, how can you tell me that cocaine or ice isn't performance enhancing? And Ben Cousins says, try it, and you tell me. Like, you know, it's bizarre to me that people would think that.
Yeah,
would be.
But I mean, it's banned if you use it on match day.
It is,
But using it outside of competition, I mean, the World Health leading experts say that that's not performance enhancing.
Yeah.
You know, if anything, be performance enhancing. So for you know, journalists or people that don't have a medical background to sort of try and overrule, you know, the best medical practitioners in this world is a big call. But yeah, look, I mean, that period of time at West Coast largely comes back to illicit drug use, and you know, no one's shying away that the culture could have been better, and there's, you know, a handful of players that have struggled with habitual drug use either during their footy career or since they retired, and that's incredibly sad for them and their families. But there's also, on a list of 45 players, you know, blokes who go to church every Sunday, blokes who finish doing their MBAs, guys that are running their own businesses successfully. There'd be, you know, 15 or so guys working in the AFL industry with young families going really well. But none of those stories are newsworthy. So the perception naturally that comes out is that the West Coast team was something akin to the Rolling Stones of the 1970s. and the reality is that it's just not how it was. So I don't think you can do much to change that perception other than remember it how it was. And I was there and I know firsthand that that premiership success was built on, you know, the hard work and the obsessiveness that shared by a collective. And it was a really special time. So nothing can really change those memories.
When's the next Carlton premiership going to be?
I don't know. I don't think it pays a lot of... I think it makes a lot of sense to try and put time limits on when it'll happen. I think...
Look, Chris, this is my podcast, right?
Yeah, I think like all clubs, the right answer to that is we're building for sustained success, and that's what all 18 clubs say. And rather than say we want to do it in 5 years' time, I think the right answer is we want to do it as quickly as possible whilst not trying to take any shortcuts.
Yeah.
So you don't just load up on 28-year-olds because that might expedite the process. You make decisions that are in the long-term interest of the club, but you try and get that sustained success as soon as possible.
Beautiful. Chris Judd, thank you so much for joining us and speaking on the Booktopia podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. And I can't recommend you enough. If you love sports books, but you like something a little bit intelligent, a little bit different, grab Inside by Chris Judd. It's fantastic. And you can get it from booktopia.com.au right now. Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.